This recording is a production of Faith Builders Resource Group. This presentation was recorded at Teachers Week 2022, held at Faith Builders on August 2 through 5.
To review from yesterday, we did several things. I really had a simple goal with the first session that I found harder to know how to actually accomplish when I set out to create the presentation there, and that is that I really just wanted you to examine the defining pieces of Christian education and ask yourself if you really know what it is. And if you somewhere deep in your soul have a sense for what it means to walk into the classroom and say, I'm going to define what I'm going to do today, this type of education as Christian. And so I had us examine some of our labels and talk about what labels can and can't do, recognizing that they have many weaknesses and that we react to them many times. But we do have a label here. We define our education as Christian education. And so what can that do for us? And just to remind you, I would submit that it can organize, define, and remind us of what we're about if we truly understand what Christian education is. So ultimately, I hope to just get you thinking and to honestly evaluate yourself and ask yourself, do I have clarity on what Christian education means for me and my school and my setting and what it looks like? And I hope that if nothing else, you leave this week thinking about that and challenged to consider the things that you do or don't do, the ways that your school goes about educating, and to consider for yourself whether you have some clarity on that idea. So what I'd like to do today is I've handed out a timeline to you, and I would like to tell some stories. I would like to look at some things in that timeline. I'm going to give a little bit of philosophy to you partway through, and I'm worried that I have too much, so I'm going to try to go pretty quickly. If you can't keep up writing some things, I know teachers are to keep PowerPoints things short, and I wasn't able to do that completely, so if you can't keep up, I can give you pieces later. So this is the timeline you have. And I would like to move quickly over some broad strokes because I'm kind of more interested in the part of the timeline that is closer to our own lives. But a bit of background here. You see, the first thing on the timeline there is that I have pre-modern epistemology. And just to be clear, epistemology is just our ways of knowing things, like how do we know things? And a pre-modern epistemology, there's obviously some conjectures to how early would that extend to. I would say possibly like say 1200 to 1600. There's some overlap with the Reformation there, give or take some. And a pre-modern epistemology is essentially that all knowledge claims were seen as faith-based. And those of you that teach history or have any interest in this know that during this particular time period, we even sometimes view the way they thought about things as a little superstitious. It was almost so faith-based that we will put that word to it. Well, there's some superstition here and there. And their belief system and the things that they believed to be true and their knowledge claims were mostly faith-based during that time. Of course, we have the Reformation kind of overlapping with that, and the Reformation brought some new ways of thinking about things. And I think rather than trying to say something really definitive about what the Reformation brought in regards to, say, knowledge versus faith or reason versus faith, I would just say that the Reformation represents a time of intense struggle, trying to figure out how faith and reason make sense with each other. And if you've studied Martin Luther, you would know some about that. So I see this time era as a faith-reason struggle. A lot of back and forth. The church trying to determine what that means for Christianity. And I have the Reformation going here on this timeline till essentially the end of the 30 Years' War. And once again, if you've studied history, you know that by the end of the 30 Years' War, you basically have Europe killing each other, trying to sort out matters of faith and reason. And so, once again, I'm kind of representing the Reformation in that way on here. Overlapping with the Reformation is the European Enlightenment. And this is talked about different ways in history classes, but quick summary, the idea that we begin to put more faith in reason and in our ability to think and discover truth out of our own minds. And so there's a bit of a growing sense that the human mind can figure things out. We can solve problems if we study and think about them hard enough. And this also birthed, I put revolution on here because not only it was a time of and a shift in how we, maybe where we put our faith, but it was also a shift in the belief in what we can solve with our actions that flow out of that knowledge. And so you have the masses being willing to revolt here. And if you're American, you know that the American Revolution falls into this time era as well. And, you know, we often study that in ways that make it look like a good thing and as something that was a noble enactment by the patriots of our country. And yet we recognize that it was birthed out of a belief in what man can do for himself and that we are free to revolt against a system that we've determined to be a bad one. So not only do we have the American Revolution, we have the French Revolution in there. So there's a variety of revolutions. And then you see up here, and I have in yellow, Immanuel Kant. And this is kind of where I want to get to for a moment here. Because he kind of breaks in on this scene, this movement and shifting of how we view the world and knowledge and how we, or maybe where we put our faith in that whole shifting of systems. And Immanuel Kant breaks into this, and I'm not studied up on philosophy, so I'm going by those that that study it more than I, but what I understand is that he's often seen as maybe the philosopher or the most influential philosopher heading into the modern world who shaped and framed what we know as the modern era. And so I want to take a moment to look at him here and his philosophy because I think it has played an incredible role in shaping modern education. So I just step away from that timeline for a bit. We're going to come back to it and I'm going to have you add some things to it. But I'm going to pull away from that for a moment here and look at another slide. And I'm calling this Kantian epistemology, or in other words, the way that Kant thought we could know things. So first of all, let me just frame a bit of the issue coming out of the Enlightenment, and that was that there was really two camps that emerged. There was the empiricist, and there were the rationalists. And the empiricist thought that we know things through experience. So if you want to know something, you go check it out. You go look at it. You go touch it. Our senses are really critical for the empiricist. You might take a measurement of something, or do an experiment. So if you want to know how hot the sun is, you know, either do an experiment or a measurement, or I guess if you could, you would go there and just see for yourself. That's the empiricist. The rationalists thought that we know things through the use of our minds, through reason, rationale. And their argument against the empiricist was that, well, your senses can deceive you. You may perceive something to be true, but what if it's a hallucination? Your senses could be wrong. And so they reasoned that we know things by thinking about them, by reasoning through our rationale, and that these things are just kind of inherently true, and we can discover that because of our ability to think about them. So things like 1 + 1 = 2. And you will not experience that any other way at any other place, is what the rationalist would say. Or all bachelors are unmarried. These things are things that we can think about and rationalize and know to be true as a result. So Kant came along, and this is a bit of the divide. And he's influential because he kind of found a middle ground that ended up shaping the modern era. You might say he blended the two a bit. I'm not sure if that's a fair way of describing it. But Kant said, no, there's some concepts like space, time, and number that are built into us as a condition of having a mind. And I don't have time to delve into this. You could, if you're interested in this type of thing, you can go check it out for yourself. But for example, a baby can recognize that, you know, you are over there and he is over here, but Kant said that apparently must be embedded in the baby, this idea of space, because it's already there. So His response is there are some things that are just simply built into us because we have a mind. And I once again, I'm not well studied on this. I would assume things that do not have a mind would not necessarily have this built into them in that case. So we have no choice but to experience the world like that. So these conditions that are built into us are like a pair of glasses that we cannot take off. So we do not have the ability to take space-time off. We have no other way to experience the world, is what Kant said. These things, now there's some things we can, but he had certain things that he said fall into this category where you can't change it. That is how you will experience the world. You do not have a choice about that. So he broke the world into kind of two parts. And the reason for this is because to try to explain what reality is on the basis of these things that, you know, that we can't remove, well, then how can we know reality? In other words, if you have no other way to look at something, then how do you know that it's actually true? Because you don't have a choice. You are hardwired to see the world in space and time, and so how would you know if there's not space and time? So what do you do with that problem? Well, Kant said, okay, apparently the world is in two categories. And the two categories are what he called the phenomenal world and the noumenal world. So the phenomenal world is the world as we experience it, including these pieces that are hardwired into us, the experience of space and time and number, and the other things that we experience. And the noumenal world is the world as it is in itself, independent of our experience. So in other words, it is kind of like what is reality or true, whether we experience it that way or not. So here's the problem. So we can never experience the noumenal world because as soon as we experience it, it's part of the phenomenal world. And this is intentionally filled with red because I don't think this is true. I think that we can experience the world as it really is because of our connection to the Creator himself and our relationship with God. And so this is an interesting progression that Kant lays out for essentially Western thought, that the world is in these two categories, and the truly real world that may exist out there that we cannot experience, there is really no way to know anything about it because once we experience it, then it's in the other category. I think that Christians view the world significantly different from this. Few things. So Kant, taken to his logical conclusion. So first, human knowledge is limited to the world of experience. So you can't know anything unless you can experience it in that case. Secondly, knowledge came to be thought of as private perceptions because it's something that we go out and experience. I have to resist the urge to give refutations to each of these because I feel them welling up inside of me. Special revelation. We believe in the Holy Spirit. There's so many things that fall outside of these categories. Thirdly, knowledge is not discovery or discernment of reality, therefore. It's the interpretations we have of our experience. Begin to redefine what knowledge is. Once we assume that there is not reality that objectively is for everyone, in other words, if it's experience-based, it's not objectively there for all people, then we become obsessed with feelings and actions. I think it's an incredible description of our era. It's incredibly obsessed with feelings and actions. Furthermore, we have no ability to intellectually critique those feelings and actions because knowledge is based on our experience once again. So, rather than ask what has Jesus already done, what is he doing, what will he do as a result of who he is, I think modern Christianity has bought into this philosophy more than we may think, and that is it possible that we're still mostly stuck wearing the what would Jesus do bracelets? obsessed with feelings and actions. These are blanket statements. Mainstream Christian education is working hard to slap a bit of faith on secular methods and philosophies of education. Once again, I'm talking broadly here. I have incredible pride and belief and faith in the movement of Christian education to actually work against these things. And it is happening, and praise the Lord for that. But I think there are subtle ways in which we have bought into this way of thinking and viewing the world because it is the air that we breathe, it is the culture that we live in the Western world. And I think we have to be thoughtful about that. One of the things that I really enjoy doing is I've always enjoyed sports, and I've been in and out of a lot of those over the years. And when I was younger, my dad had to dig his heels into the ground and make rules about what we could and couldn't do. And my brothers and I have, by the way, I have four brothers, and so I grew up playing many heated games with them. And when we played sports, I think my brothers are the people that I got the most angry at when I was playing a sport. So I grew up playing sports and really enjoyed that. And my dad did a good job, I think, of trying to keep us in check there. I don't know if it always worked out perfectly, but we worked at it. And I can still remember, I played in a few Christian softball leagues over the years. And, if you have any experience with these, it's really interesting. I remember the first time we were starting a tournament, and I'm standing around with a bunch of guys. These are church-going guys, they're Christians. And, of course, you start the tournament off with prayer because this is a church league, right? So we prayed, and I remember when we got done with the prayer, what caught me off guard, I clearly didn't know the system, is there was this little chant that just everybody obviously knew what to say, and it went something like this: Jesus is the reason for the season. And we go play softball. Really caught me by surprise when they kind of cut loose with this little thing. And then, general war ensued after that. And ultimately, there's just a variety of people that do these things. And so there's a lot of a variety of characters there. But I've seen grown men act like babies in church softball leagues. Absolute babies. One of the things that I think we ought to think about are things like the place of sports in our educational systems. I mentioned integration the other day. What does it mean to actually integrate God into our educational efforts? I don't tend to be critical of church softball leagues. I'm still trying to decide whether I'll let my son do them. I haven't thought through that enough yet. I have a few years. But I think that there's been some failure on that front to make that softball league truly Christian, simply by saying Jesus is the reason for the season before we slug it out with each other and whine at the ump and all of that type of thing. So I ask us to consider what it is about our educational efforts that really are Christian and reflect the character of Jesus, and to understand a bit of where we've come from. Hence the timeline. However, I have one other piece I want to share with you before we dive into that timeline, because I think it connects to the underlying philosophy of the modern era. So a bit of a response, and this comes from the book here that I already mentioned, from Smith. And that is to begin by recognizing that every human knowledge claim is inherently faith-based because God is the creator of all reality, and no single reality can be rightly understood unless it is understood in relation to God and brought into service to Him. Now, some of you may be familiar, there's been talk over the years about a sacred-secular divide and how there shouldn't be one. I'm not actually talking about that here. I hear something a bit different here that I'm going to describe as good faith and bad faith. And that is, I mentioned it the other day, that all knowledge claims really are faith-based to some extent. And though the modern era has tried to convince us that good thinking eliminates the need for faith, I would actually wager that all thinking involves faith, and there's good faith and there's bad faith. And I want to describe a bit of that. I want to get a bit practical here. I'm going to tell you a quick story. So my brother-in-law is in medical school right now. And so I'd like to talk to him about what he's experiencing and what he's learning. And he's been there for quite a while now, working hard. And he told me a story recently that I found very fascinating. So I have here a bit of a chart to help kind of organize the story. So he's described to me that in class he's learned that fine elements of who we are and how to treat different diseases and just a plethora of things can be determined by simply looking at the genome of the person that you're treating. And they teach this. You can know these things. You can absolutely know the eye color of a person by looking at the genome of that person. He's been taught these things. You can absolutely know many things about a person by looking at the genetic code. It'll tell you these things and give you clues about how you ought to treat someone, how you ought not to treat someone. So he's been learning these things at the school that he's been going to. But what was intriguing to me is he said they also invited a guest lecturer to come. And it was a man in his 80s, I believe, who has been in the medical field for a long time and is considered a bit of an expert and a specialist, I guess. And the point of his lecture was that there is no way to determine the gender of a child. You cannot know. Yeah, there and he tried to, he was working hard. My brother said he was working hard to explain this in terms of genome and medicine. What's interesting is, you know, immediately my brother-in-law is saying, I'm seeing a conflict of information in what the school is presenting to me. So we sit in class and we're told that you can determine a treatment absolutely by looking at the genome of your patient. We have a guest lecturer come in and say, you cannot know whether a child is a male or a female. I submit to you, every knowledge claim is faith-based. This is a whole faith system, obsessed with feelings and actions. There are certainly things that are true, knowledge that is being taught in those classes that are accurate and represent the way God created the universe, but there's a whole belief system here that I think I would say there's a desire for it to be true. And it requires faith to make it work out, and they're working hard at it. This is actually a quote from C.S. Lewis, and I see I was rushing a bit here before. I forgot some quotation marks and his name. Non-Christian views, and I will say non-Christian faith, ultimately revolves around what the individual likes or wants things to be. I see that going on in the story that of my brother-in-law there. There is actually a desire for things to be a certain way. We want them to be a certain way, and so working hard to make that happen, trying to bring knowledge into that. And I think here lies the problem with submitting our children to secular education, not that some teacher will give my child a fact that is not true. I give my students facts that are not true. I'm sometimes simply wrong. The problem with submitting my child to secular education is that it is bad faith. And so I come back to what I hope I'm really calling us to by this time, and that is to consider our faith and to recognize that Christian education is not faith-based versus secular education not being faith-based. I think that Christian education is good faith. And there's a lot of bad faith out there. I'm going to run out of time, so we're going to have to let that at that for now. Let's go back to our timeline. I'm going to throw some pieces in here. I'm going to move somewhat quickly. So we got the first Mennonites to America. By the way, I'm giving these talks in Canada in a week. I'm going to need some of you Canadians to help me know how to like put in the Canadian pieces here, because I'm not sure about that. I don't know Canadian history. So first Mennonites to America, throw that in here. Important piece here is we have an educational point, I think, Christopher Dock, and I would love to tell you more about Christopher Dock right now, but one of the main things is, leading up to his time, schoolmasters kind of used a harsh, rigid approach, and he had a gentler approach that he would have taught that would have, I think, emphasized a little more relationship with the students, and that you massage a child to knowledge versus whooping them to knowledge. Interestingly enough, I think our world would still probably see Christopher Dock as whooping people to knowledge because we've moved quite a distance. There are two other names in here, Thomas Jefferson and John Adams. And the reason I add them to the timeline here is these were two of the first American founding fathers to push for a unified version of education. And they wanted it early on. And once again, I'd like to give you more of their reasoning. I don't have time for that. Some of it was just they felt in order for a democratic country to function, you had to have citizens that were well-trained and knew how to function within it. And so if everyone's just free to educate themselves however they want to, like, this isn't going to work. And so their thought was, we got to get our children educated in a unified manner. Another name I want to put on the timeline, Horace Mann, 1830. He was from Massachusetts. And really, I think one could argue that he was the impetus for what we would call public education, or education being available to anybody for free. And he pushed for this in Massachusetts and started what we call, or they called at that time, common schools. They didn't really call them public schools, they called them common schools. And several of their goals were the three R's at that time. They wanted to promote a strong dose of moral instruction. So the idea was to create morally upright young people. Civic virtues were important, how to belong to the country well. The intention was to cross social classes. Once again, in our era, we would probably look back and say they did a pathetic job of it, but they did. Their intention was to get across the social classes and not make education something for just the rich. They thought that one of the arguments was that, well, it'd be better to educate and train people to be good, moral, civic citizens than to pay to deal with them in jails later on. So they actually saw this as an economic improvement. Some of those that opposed were the parents. It was a new idea to consider helping to pay for someone else's education. And that one hasn't completely gone away, but that was a new idea for them. I want you to note that it was not long after that that we had our first public elementary schools, and then we eventually got public high schools, and I want to take a closer look at that in the last few minutes here of our session. So I'm going to zoom in on that section, and that's where your other timeline might be helpful. So I have on here, we've already talked about these guys, Christopher Talk, Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, Horace Mann. These guys, by the 1800s, they've already been doing some work here, and that work does actually culminate in the formation of the availability of public education, now only at the elementary level. So that's where you see here, 1830 to 1870, we actually have kind of the formation of public school at the elementary level. Then later, we have the high schools showing up. So first off, just an interesting thing to note here. In this era right in here, an important thing that was going on was the consolidation of Germany at that time. So Germany's becoming something, and we know that it builds to World War I eventually. Those of you that studied history might be familiar with the name Otto von Bismarck. And one of the things that Germany was doing really well is they were doing a great job of creating a bit of a public education system in Germany. And the Western world's looking on there, in this case, America, saying, how do we keep up? We got to step up our game. These guys aren't joking around. And so there's actually part of one of the things that helped usher in high school was an attempt to keep up with the powerhouses of the world at that time. So Germany put pressure on America to step up our educational game. Another thing that happened in here is that teaching was professionalized. So before this, who were your teachers? We had one-room schoolhouses. We had small efforts, mostly based on the local community. And, you know, you could argue that someone like Christopher Dock was a professional teacher, but there was no system of professionalizing teaching before this. So one of the things that was done to take our game up here was to actually make this a profession where someone could be trained in it and actually do it. Teachers could do this in a similar way and do it well. And it culminated in certified teachers, essentially downstream far enough. So down here, I have first wave, and what I mean here is the first wave of Mennonites out of the public education system. And there's essentially two waves that we're going to look at here. This is the first wave. And One of the main issues here, and there were others, but an issue was this thing of saluting the flag. And so that became a breaking point for many of our Anabaptist ancestors, and they said, we got to pull out of here, we can't do this. And so my understanding, the first Mennonite private school is Greenwood, Delaware, 1928, followed by some other schools. Some of you would have some connections here, Locust Grove and Lancaster Mennonite High School, or some of you may have had grandparents that attended these schools. They quickly followed suit. So we have a wave of Anabaptists out of the public school system during this era. I want you to note where that falls. And that is that it falls kind of here towards the end of World War I and a bit after. And there's some reason for that. Obviously, following World War I, nationalism really rose to the surface, which is why you see schools pushing saluting the flag and this type of thing. Anabaptists came up against nationalism. Weren't sure what to do with that. So some pulled out. World War II, I think, is also an interesting piece because it also inspired another wave, in a sense, out of the public school system. And it was based on some other things. But one of the things that was interesting here, an element that kind of stands alone, and I want to reference it, is that so in World War I, a lot of our some of our parents were conscientious objectors and did 1W service. And one of the things they discovered in 1W service was that we actually have the ability to interact with the world, and there's a mission field there. And so a lot of these folks came back from 1W service with mission fervor. And so one of the things we started to think about is that being something that our schools could contribute to. And so suddenly, not only were we interested in educating our children in math, say, what about training them in things that would give them the ability to engage in mission activity? And so World War II gave us some other impetuses there to try to do education on our own. There was also some other pieces that followed with that and created a second wave down here. And that second wave kind of followed the 1970s there, and a couple things that you could say were maybe straws that broke the camel's back: television, secular education required phys ed, sex education became more of a thing, and it was also the end of Bible reading and prayer in the public schools. And so some things that, once again, inspired some to say, this is not for us. We believe there's something out there that is different than this for our young people. Now, I want to pause here for a second, just insert a few interesting little stories. First off, I'm old enough to remember my great-grandfather, Burkholder. And he lived right across the street from us growing up, and I would sometimes deliver the mail to him, and I would get an Andy's Mint from him for delivering the mail. And to this day, I love Andy's Mints. And so he would have grown up in this era right in here. And it's interesting because he grew up in the era when school was not compulsory. So he would talk about wanting to go to school and worried that his dad would say that he couldn't go to school because they had too much work to do. So they would go to school during the winter, and particularly in the spring when they were, those of you that farm know, that's the time of the year when you haul a lot of manure. He was always just pining to go to school and hoping his dad wouldn't say, hey, we've got to haul manure today. He wanted to go to school, but really only went to school during the wintertime. One generation later, my grandpa would have been more in this area in here. Compulsory education, he had to go to school. He was going to school every day, attending the public school. Shift just in that generation. Then you have my dad, who is down here right in this area, right during the time when many of these schools were moving out of the public school system. My dad still went to public school. He graduated from public school in, I think, 72 or 73. And following him, my dad's younger siblings went to a Christian day school. And so in my own family, I kind of see this progression of what to do with secular education. Does it work for us? Is there something distinctly different that we really want for our children? One of the things that emerged here that I wish I had on my slide and I don't, especially here, with the arrival of a public high school, was the development of what I would call a youth culture that did not exist before public high school. Think back about the efforts, you know, let's just take Hitler in Germany. He understood this, and that is if you formulate a great educational system, you can create a youth culture, and we know that Hitler had a youth culture going on in Germany. I don't know how much intentionality went into this in our country, but it certainly happened, whether it was something that they intentionally tried to create or it was just a result of public high school. You know, it's interesting, I was talking to Jonas a bit yesterday, and so, you know, the Amish did understand something that there's a point to, and that is that up to eighth grade is one thing, and there is something different about, you know, 13 to 18. And the arrival of the public education system for high schoolers demonstrated that. There was a culture that emerged, a youth culture, that I don't think can quite exist or emerge at the middle school and lower level. And of course, you know, there's the hippie movement in the 60s, get to, you know, rocking and rolling here. And a lot of that stuff was very much embedded with this youth culture. I think that youth culture is one of the things that made Christians sit up and wonder if this is a place for our young people. Interesting story in this second wave. One of the bishops in my home community in southern Pennsylvania was against starting a Christian day school because he went to the public school system in the 1920s and he didn't think it was that bad. And as the story goes, there were some in the church that were pushing to start a new school. And by the way, there's another whole story, and that is once we did start, did we actually know what we were doing? Maybe he actually understood something about that, where he was like, this is a big deal to just pull out and educate our own children. For whatever reason, he was against it. And there was this push to start a Christian day school in the community. His name was Amos Martin, and I think he was in his 70s. He was a bishop, and he was against it. But finally, one day, he said to himself, I'm going to go down to the local public school, and I'm just going to observe, going to watch. And he didn't even go in the school. He just went down and parked in the parking lot at dismissal time there in Chambersburg and watched the students come out of the school. He went home and told his wife, he said, we're doing school. I think he realized there is a youth culture that we don't want our young people in. And it's not just about the facts that are taught at school. There's actually other things going on here that are more holistically connected to who we are as people. So, we're out of time here. Got to let you go for lunch. What I do want to just pop one here real quick is we talked about these yesterday, and I want to highlight this one here at the end of our session today, already mentioned. I do think this one is critical because at the governmental level, it was a ruling by the Supreme Court that opened the door for a variety of ways of doing education. As I heard one person say, I think on YouTube, he said, if you want to do school in your jammies, go hug an Amish man. Or if you like doing school in your jammies. Because, you know, we got the whole homeschool movement that came out of this. Homeschool movement would not be possible had not the Supreme Court ruled that based on religious conviction, you have the freedom to educate your own. So I'll leave you with this. There's the homeschool movement that has come out of this era. There's obviously the parochial private school, as many of us are involved in, community schools. Now we know there's online schooling. Just do your own. It's been a long journey to get there, and I just have one piece that I kind of want to throw out here at the end, and this has less to do with maybe the philosophical underpinnings and more to just do with the cultural underpinnings to say, we've been through a long journey. One of the primary issues is the nationalism that we had to face and we're not sure what to do with. We've actually been given freedom to educate our young people according to the values of the kingdom of God versus the kingdoms of this earth. And I do not understand why so much of Christian education is determined to go back to nationalism. It's been a long journey to get here, and I'm not quite sure what all is good or good and bad about it yet, but I do know that we have a tremendous opportunity where at this moment in time, we are free to educate our own young people according to kingdom values. And it's disappointing to me, I think, to see much of Christian education, I'm talking about mainstream Christian education here, seems to have lost its way on this and seems to be determined to just simply educate our children like everybody else is doing it. And so I come back to saying, what is distinctly Christian about what you're doing? Are you actually educating in a way that represents kingdom values? Or are you just finding ways to implement what the secular educational systems are doing and putting Christian clothing on it? And praise the Lord. One of the things that I would just say here is that I think you all are very lucky. If you sit here today and you say, you know what? I've always felt like my little school of 15, 20 students is just nothing. If we could just become a big school that had, you know, more oomph to it, then we'd be educating. I'm not so sure. Some of the schools that you teach at that function in that format, I think are very conducive to Christian education. So blessings on you as you teach in those places. We're out of time, and it's time for lunch. Thank you for your attention.
This recording and many others are available through Christian Learning Resource, the campus bookstore at Faith Builders. Order online at www.christianlearning.org or call 877-222-4769.